Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Real 6. Now, we're talking about your training at the Air Gunnery School, and you mentioned the camera gun. Was there any other sorts of training you were doing? Because I'm thinking about deflection shooting.
Yeah.
They actually taught you the principles of deflection shooting at Northcote.
Yes. The training, first of all, when you were doing live firing, whether it be air-to-air or air-to-ground, the Lewis gun behaved like all mechanical devices, are subject to breaking down and having stoppages and all sorts of unnecessary things, which you were taught a drill on how to clear them and how to recognize them. And
now, what do you remember? We'll do that first.
I remember it loud and clear to this very day, and I'll tell you about it subsequently. But the thing about it was a drill. As an armourer, we had been taught it anyway. But when you went to air gunner's school, you had it was a refresher, really. But such things as I seem to remember the phrase: the gun stops firing. Strike the magazine in a clockwise direction and continue firing. Well, this is only to prove that the magazine was empty, or alternatively, it's a hiccup. And then the position of the cocking lever on the gun would indicate whether it had fed around into the breech partially. And you had two tools. Armors had them anyway in the toolkit, but the air gunners had them. Tool removing stoppage. No, beg your pardon. Tool removing separated case, because sometimes the case broke. The bullet went into the breech and the case broke off, so you had to get it. It was a little device like a pair of tweezers, except it was operated from the breech mechanism. You push this expanding tube up the breech, and then when you put the breech forward, the bolt, it spread it and clamped on the inside, and by wiggling it and wiggled it back and forward and pulled it out. There was also a claw device for hooking out cases. There was also another tool clearing stoppage. It was a general term, but it was had a 6 or 8 inch cable on the end with a loop, which you could get on, loop it around the cocking lever and give it a mefty heave, and thereby it had stuck forward. That was the theory.
That sounds as if it would be really difficult at 15,000 feet.
Well, it was. It was really difficult, but it's a point was coming on to development. It was a point that armourers learned to use. It applied equally to the Vickers guns in the front gun of pilots. They had these tools, but their machine guns were different. But they were taught to do this, and we were taught to be able to instruct them to do it. But the expansion of the Air Force progressed, the Lewis guns were subsequently replaced with the Vickers gas operated gun. It was a free gun fitting.
Now, were you introduced to that at Northcote?
No. The only one that we ever saw when it was on the course, the initial course, 1934.
So
we saw. They showed us a Browning gun, a 303 Browning, no, it was a 300 Browning gun. 0.300 Browning gun and a 0.50 Browning gun. It showed us that as a demonstration in the classroom. So it wasn't until 1937-ish. Yeah, 1937, that I encountered physically the Browning guns, because my next posting was to Hemswell, and the squadron was equipped with Blenheims. I'll come to that later on.
So anything else about this course you were doing?
Yeah, it was a course as far as the armours was concerned. Good. The thing I remember about that, we had a, inverted commas, a mad flight sergeant pilot who took himself, it was the time of the Spanish Civil War, and he took himself off on unofficial leave and went out to Spain to fight for the Spaniards, or with the Spaniards, or whoever he was fighting against. I suppose it was court-martial, but it don't matter, he obviously survived. But no, it was a remote place. It only lasted a month. And
Just October to November, or basically.
Yeah, the month it was, you know, because then, having sat the written examination and done the test, we were promulgated then as qualified air gunners, i.e., and authorized to wear fine bullets.
We didn't cover deflection. I mean, how did they train you in deflection?
Well, as I said early on, the armors were very good candidates for part-time aircrew, and that was one of the reasons. We were given a sound theory indoctrination on deflection shooting and also bombing. So we knew all the mathematics about it. We knew what it was about. And I always remember at Northcote, one of the things they used to ram home to the gunners was when they were doing those camera guns exercises, when their target approaches at an angle of 45 degrees diving, right, you track the target. By that they mean you follow the target down with the gun, and you allow the target to come a quarter of the distance, I think it's a quarter of the distance inside the ring before you open fire. And that stuck with me all the way through my service career, I might tell you. And the first time, that was a good thing, because that's how you learn. And the mechanics of the stoppages, the mechanics, when I say the mechanics, the patter, you know, striking the magazine in the clockwise direction, et cetera, and looking at the cock and position of the gun and knowing what to do.
Now, in the war, the air gunners were routinely encouraged to do clay pigeon shooting and things like that.
That was deflection shots.
Did you do any of that?
No, we didn't. It wasn't introduced in our day, basically. We knew about it. It wasn't the emphasis. We did it in camera gun exercises on the squadrons when we did a camera gun exercise, which wasn't very often.
Anything else about your training or about the examination at the end?
The other thing, as I was saying about the training, you got indoctrinated. You've probably, the anomaly is that you've probably heard the stories of the gunners in the desert during the war who, as you know, firing the artillery, they went through a routine, and if a fellow was knocked out, another guy took his place. Well, all that was automatic training. These guys did it because they were been taught to do it, same as we were taught to do it. I mean, simple things like when we were doing bombing, there's a procedure for finding the wind speed and direction. And I could recite it to you now if you wished.
Yes, I do.
But, you know, it says, the patter went this way. It said, on any course, adjust for drift. But that didn't mean check the drift on the one way. So you've preset all the other bits and pieces. Unclamp, down ruler, and draw a line. Red on red, down ruler, and draw a line. That's China graph and on the top of the compass rose. And then you turn through 60 degrees, check for drift, unclamp, red on red, down roll and draw a line. And then you check through another 60 degrees or 120 degrees the other way, down roller, down and draw a line. And what you get on the top of your compass rose is you get three lines intersecting. That distance from this intersection to the center of the rose is the wind speed, and the direction is marked off on the compass rose. That thing has never left my memory, as if it happened yesterday. And it was a pattern which you went through hundreds of times. But that's why we divert. We haven't left Vista yet.
So was there a formal passing out? I mean, was there an examination?
You did your practical examination, and you did your There was. There must have been a written test, yes. I think I passed out at 75%, I think. I think I got 75%.
Now, what was your rank then? Were you
AC2. Aircraftman second class, stroke armourer, stroke air gunner, after I passed out. And it's promulgated here. Very good, it said. laugh when I look at this. Armourer. Air gunners, very good. It doesn't say percentage. I read it somewhere, 75%, which was quite good. I was quite happy.
So you went back to Bicester in November.
I report to Bicester now, and whilst there was a vacancy, I was promulgated as, to quote the phraseology, authorised to draw crew pay and badge pay. this is what amused me. Authorised to draw aircrew pay, which is a shilling a day, and badge pay. Now, as I said to you, when I got my service record subsequently, it starts in the 11th of October 1936, and it carries right through to 1940. And all the entries are in manuscript.
So it was probably
that was just sheer coincidence, I suppose, because I was in the right place. But what we must appreciate is, having returned to the squadron now as an AC2 armour stroke air gunner, they were very keen, the squadron, to get you into the flying aspect. So in addition to my jobs as an armourer, I was put under tutorage, if that's the right expression, with this Corporal Brooks. And he was keen, he was an excellent bomb airman, and he was keen to get somebody else to become good, you know, to double up with him, because he never got any time off, literally, because he was always bombing. So Corporal Brooks took me under his wing, and I had done all the theory. I mean, it was two-thirds of the way there. I just needed practice. And so that's where it all started. And the practice went on and on and on. But you can see from 1936 until our operations and when the war started in the Middle East in what time did it start? June 40, that's right. I had something in the region of about 800 flying hours. Now, that in peacetime was quite a lot of flying hours, and it's also a lot of experience, because the bulk of it was done on navigation and bombing. So, having said that, we have now become a fully qualified.
Now, that was in.
I'm still at Bicester.
You probably went to the North Coast in September if you qualified in October.
Yeah, that's right.
So, if you're back to Bicester in October.
I went back to the squadron.
How did your life change? I mean, were you still living in the armourer's hut?
Oh, yeah, I never moved. We just got on. The same guys were there. The frequency of posting wasn't there. But what I was going to say was that, being a Scot, they were rather keen to, they looked after me. And of course, Christmas time, I didn't go home at Christmas, I went home at New Year. And this is 1936, isn't it?
October 36.
Yeah, 1936. The things that happened to me, I remember, I mentioned the bombing ranges and parts of these, but one thing I do remember, I remember the abdication speech being made.
That's in 36 or 37?
It was 36, I think it was 36.
What do you remember of that? How did it affect you?
Pardon?
How did you react to the abdication?
I remember I was sitting in the Naffy at Bicester, in the Airman's Naffy in Bicester, and the speech was made, and we didn't react in as much, too much. We just thought, oh, that's a bit sad. We've now got a new king. Didn't make a lot of difference to a young lad of 17, 18. But we did duly note it. And then shortly after that, but it was actually Boxing Day of the same year. This is another bit of history. Rothermere Bomber, which was the forerunner of the Blenheim, Lord Rothermere's Britain's first, the forerunner of the Blenheim, arrived on the unit with a test pilot so that the squadron pilots, A, could handle this thing and see it and have a look at it. And I've got some pictures, actually, on Boxing Day. I remember it clearly, 1936. I was privileged to fly in this thing with the...
What was it? Was it called the Rothermere?
The Blenheim. Yeah, the original Blenheim. The Britain's first.
You're attached.
Oh, sorry. Well, I've done it.
They can't see it anyway, so...
They're not... I had the actual cutting here. I just picked that out. That's not it there in that picture, but that's the story about it.
So this was a Blenheim. It was just
a prototype Blenheim.
What did you think of this prototype?
It's fantastic. Don't forget, it was a civil airliner, custom built for Lord Rothermere. It had been designed in the preceding 3 years, and this was 1936. Beautiful leather upholstery and beautiful polished mahogany instrument panel and very posh civilian-type instruments. And very fast, a retractable undercarriage. So the pilots on the squadron, one or two of the pilots, were allowed to handle this thing, take it off and land it. And I sat in the back and observed the aircraft in general, and it was really fast. But that was a historical importance as far as the history of the Blenheim is concerned. And I remember that Boxing Day, and I was proudly photographed alongside this thing. So having said that, the next episode was, we carried on. The squadron routine was pretty much the same. It didn't vary. The only thing was that after about the first 6 months, we had a flight sergeant in charge. We didn't have any. The officers were only figureheads in terms of armament officers. The flight sergeant, he was a fitter armor, Group 1. He was IC, the Army. And as I said, the Army was a part of the headquarters building. It had a permanent armory at one end, which is barred windows and lockers and chains and big doors, and the next bit further up was the NCO's office and lecture room and workshops. Still there, still exists now. And one of the chores I got there when I first went as a young boy, I used to make the tea. Not unusual, but I suppose like everything else, I was reasonably enthusiastic. But the corporal who was in charge of a billet, he said, "Well, you can make the tea for us if you want to." I set up this, what we called in the trade, the plumbers called it, the tea swindle. He made tuppence a head a week, and he used to have cocoa in the morning and coffee and tea in the afternoon. No coffee in his day. If I was out on the flights working, I had to scoot back to the armory, and in the workshops I'd set up a primer stove and all that business. And I had all the cups. Somebody else washed them up, but I had them all. And they ran this tea swindle for years. Became a routine. But it worked all right. But when I got involved in the flying, well, I was an airman by that time. The other guys got some of the jobs, But that carried on until I was posted.
So how long were you there for?
I was posted in February 1937.
So you weren't there that long then?
Just over a year. From September 1935. Yeah, just over a year.
So where to next?
I was posted. I should have said that. I was posted then, but... In between, during this period, the Air Force was expanding.
And now, do you want to talk a bit about the expansion of the Air Force? How obvious was that to you?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty obvious, because whilst at Bicester, we knew of squadrons being formed, but then 48 Squadron was formed from Sea Flight 101 Squadron. And 48 Squadron was the first Anson Squadron in the Royal Air Force. And the first Anson Squadron, the first Ansons, duly arrived. And they bent three of them. They forgot about the wheels, the usual. They were so strange that the pilots who were flying them landed them with the wheels up. They didn't do a lot of damage, but it was inconvenient somewhat. But we had a new aircraft to play with, and again...
What did you think of the Anson?
Oh, it was a lovely aircraft. I'll come to that, because this 48 Squadron was formed at Bicester and moved off to Manston. I wasn't posted with it, but some of the armourers went. And they went to Manston to form the navigation school for the RAF. I think it was 48 Squadron. That's where they started the navigation. But having worked on the Ansons, that was great. I was then, at that juncture, because of the expansion, and when I say expansion, the squadrons were opening up literally right, left and centre, but they weren't staffed. You know, you had a name, you might have a couple of aeroplanes and two or three technicians, in inverted commas, and you didn't have any tools. You had a pair of pliers and a screwdriver if you were lucky, which I was lucky, because armour's always seemed to fall on their feet for tools. But I was posted to 144 Squadron at Hemswell, another famous squadron, believe it or not. Now,
and Hemswell, that's
Hemswell in Lincolnshire. And as an AC-2 armour stroke air gunner. Mustn't forget the air gunner. So when I got to Hemswell as an AC-2 armour, Hemswell is a big pre-war base for hangar. The hangars were finished. There was no runways there, but the living accommodation was wooden huts. The officer's mess was a wooden structure. The guard room was a wooden structure. And the billets were wooden structures. But it's about a mile and a half from Canby Corner, a few miles north of Scampton. In fact, it's 12 miles from Lincoln, I think, not up the A14. Anyway, we were living in these wooden huts. And when I say they were, just literally 28 to a billet, barracks long. All nicely kept, meticulously clean, of course. We still had the routine of inspections and things of that nature, and we had the privilege of a corporal in charge of each billet who lived in the bunk. In our case, I always remember the guy in charge, Ken Levac. I remember him. I was just turned 18, and Ken Levac lived in the billet, and the billet was at one end, and the ablutions were outside ablutions at the other end. So when he had to go, he walked through the. And I always remember this because he'd come from Hong Kong, and he wore this dressing gown, Chinese, and had a great big dragon. It's about a 5-foot dragon on the back with red eyes. I remember, and at night it used to literally glow. Big panic, you see this apparition walking. However, that was just a thing.
What was he like, this Ken Vac?
Ken Levac, he was very quiet. I can't remember what he was. I think he was a fitter. I can't remember. He was a very, very dark, Chinese-looking guy, really, but he wasn't. When he retired when we were at Hemswell, and he bought out the local pub. I can't remember what it's called now. It's no longer there now. He got pally with a landlady, inverted commas, and he retired from the Air Force and bought this pub. I'm not sure if it was the Royal Oak. Anyway, it's been demolished.
But how did you settle in at Hemswell?
Well, I was all right. I mean, I was... we were all right. We had a mixed bunch of guys, because they'd come from numerous squadrons. Flight mechanics, mainly, flight riggers. The armour as well. There was armourers now. There was I was the only, I had to make new armament friends because I didn't know any of them. I remember the flight sergeant there in charge of the army was a bit of a disciplinarian. Ooh, he didn't let you get away with anything. But it didn't make any difference. If you did your job, you're all right. But and I can't remember the other guys. There was only about six of us in the armory, as opposed to when we were at Bicester, we had about 15 or so. But I was the only air gunner. So that sort of marked me up, I suppose. And this flight sergeant, I don't think he was awfully keen on the fact, but nevertheless, he was a good flight sergeant, very good, very well organized, very meticulous. And we had two types of aircraft. We had Hawker-Ordax, which is a Hart variant, Hawker-Ordax, Army Corporation style, and Anson's. So that was good ball because I had been on Harts, I knew.
Well, tell us about the Hawker-Ordax first. What sort? How different was it from the Hart?
Well, there wasn't a lot of difference. The engine was different, and it had a hook for picking up messages from the ground. The idea was Army Corporation style aircraft, and its main difference was it had a great big exhaust pipe which flowed out of the engine and along the fuselage, as opposed to the Hart, which had no exhausts at all, stubs. The gun, everything else was the same, and it was fitted with a bomb sight as well. Yeah, it had a bomb sight as well. And to operate the bomb sight, you had to lay flat on the floor and slide the floor, had a sliding, and you wound the bomb sight down on a little spigot, and it went down about a foot or 18 inches into the radiator, the slipstream from the radiator. I was writing to a historian recently, and he didn't know this. I said, well, it was terrible. I said, you got all the heat off the radiator, went straight through. It was nice and comfortable, but very hot. And it was even worse when you were overseas. But we did the usual things, gunnery. We did, in these days, we did some bombing on the actual airfield. But it was mainly concerned with camera gun work and cross countries in the Anson.
Which was your main aircraft?
My flight had the Harts and the other, but it did work. We did, because of the shortage of armourers.
The Hart, you mean the Audax?
Sorry, Audax, yes. Audax.
So the other flight had Ansons?
The Anson had predominantly Ansons, but they were, the pilots seemed to be pretty well interchangeable in these days. The other squadron down the way on the other half of the airfield had the same setup.
And when are you going to talk about the Anson? Do you want to leave that still till you were on the...
Well, you know, I can talk about the Anson. Well, the Anson, very comfortable aircraft. It's notorious in as much as that the second pilot, navigator, or call him what you is, was responsible for winding the undercarriage up 138 turns, and everybody who flies in an Anson will remember the wind in this blitz. But we used to fly around Lincolnshire, fly on one engine. Great, it was quite good in these days. Quite fast, if I remember, about 140 pounds. Quite lovely visibility, great for the wireless operator. And we didn't carry it. We had a turret, but we didn't use it. There was a gun, a turret in the back, but it was predominantly for bombing and cross-country navigation exercises, which I had got my fair whack there, quite a lot. So, what else have I got on Hemswell?